the future.
There are no people.
There are no people in the future.
No people at all.
There are no people in the future.
Where did all my people go?
There are no people in the future.
Let me try my people call.
Hey everybody, it is Friday, March 19th, 2021. Welcome to Raging Chicken's Out to Coop podcast. Hopefully we've got some of our sound issues that we've been having kind of worked out. This is why I'm a little hesitant right now. I hate to have we go to cut. Looks like we're all good so far. Fantastic. This is Kevin Mahoney, editor and founder of Raging Chicken. Each week I talk to unemployed Trump staffer Sean Kitchen about the good, the bad, and the ugly in state and national politics. Yes, we are streaming live on our YouTube channel right now. Thank you all for joining us on our YouTube channel. So if you are watching us right now, make sure you hit that subscribe button. Make sure you like this stream and make sure you hit that little bell so you know that every time we go live. excuse me. Oh my gosh. On today's show, On today's show, I'm a little bit disorganized once again. Can you believe it? On today's show, Tuesday, eight people were killed as part of an anti-Asian misogynist attack on three spas in Atlanta. Six of the eight people killed were Asian women. The killer was arrested. Cherokee County Sheriff's Office Captain Jay Baker held a news conference on Wednesday and said that the shooter had a sex addiction and was just having a bad day. It was later revealed that Captain Baker had been pushing anti-Asian t-shirts with the slogan COVID-19 imported virus from China. Yeah, I gotta love that. Philadelphia Councilmember Helen Jim called the shootings, quote, the latest escalation in the nation's history of systemic racism and violence against Asian immigrants fostered by a culture of white supremacy and misogyny that has long devalued the lives of immigrants, black women, and women of color. Proud Boys leaders in four states were arrested this week. Yes, and one of the four leaders was arrested right here in Philadelphia. Yes, native Zach Reel. Reel became a figurehead of the organization over the last 3 years. He was photographed at the insurrection, leading the Proud Boys to the Capitol, and smoking a cigarette inside Senator Merkley's office while wearing a Temple's Owl school bag the whole time. This comes on the heels of a report of how federal, state, and local agencies ignored the Proud Boys over the last 4 years while they were committing acts of political violence at Trump events and far-right rallies. And Deb Haaland was confirmed as the first Native American cabinet secretary in history. Haaland will lead the Department of the Interior, that department with a long and strained history with indigenous communities. The agency manages over 500 million acres of public land, much of it stolen from indigenous peoples. And the agency also houses the Bureau of Indian Affairs. And the filibuster appears to be on life support as President Biden and key Democratic senators are coming out and for reforming it. This prompted Mitch McConnell to throw a temper tantrum on the Senate floor, legitimate temper tantrum, seriously, where he promised to go scorched earth. Like, really? Really? And Democrats responded by saying McConnell already went scorched earth. It's already burnt, bud. Little turtle face. Crazy. And Spain may become the first country to move to a four-day work week. That follows the launch of a pilot program. Yes, exactly. A pilot project for companies in the country interested in the concept. And unlike what you get in the U.S., there's actually a lot of companies that are actually interested in participating in this. They're like, oh, that sounds like a great idea. Spain has a long history of leading on shorter working hours. Following a 44-day strike in Barcelona in 1919, for example, Spain became one of the first countries in Europe to move to an 8-hour day. As reported in The Guardian, quote, from New Zealand to Germany, the idea has been steadily gaining ground globally, hailed by its proponents as a means to increase productivity, improve the mental health of workers, and fight climate change. The proposal has taken on new significance as the pandemic sharpens issues and around well-being, burnout, and work-life balance, unquote. And the pilot program will see a reduction of working hours with no loss of salary or jobs. That's the key. Now, this won't come as a surprise, but The Guardian reports that, quote, the oil industry knew at least 50 years ago that air pollution for burning fossil fuels posed serious risks to human health, only to spend decades aggressively lobbying against clean air regulations, unquote. The report is based on a pile of internal documents obtained by The Guardian, including internal memos and reports. The CDC is exploring whether 3 feet of social distancing instead of, 6 feet is going to be safe for schools. The distancing guidelines are a key part to determining the most effective way to reopen schools while keeping students, faculty, staff, and communities safe. And 21 states with Republican attorneys general are suing the Biden administration for putting the kibosh on the Keystone XL pipeline. Yeah, good luck with that lawsuit. Moderna begins to study the safety and effectiveness of its vaccine for kids between the age of 6 months and 12 years old. And the study will enroll about 6,750 kids in the U.S. and in Canada. And the graduate student workers at Columbia University are on strike after failing to achieve their first contract after over 2 years of negotiations with the administration. This fight, this labor fight at Columbia has been, it's been a critical in a long struggle for recognition for graduate student workers. And they're looking for kind of neutral third-party arbitration. They're looking for a $4,000 increase in the stipends and summer funding, recognition for the full unit, including undergraduate and MA workers, a union shop, and healthcare fund for $250,000 per year, partial coverage of dental premiums for PhD workers. A little closer to home this week, Bucks County Assistant District Attorney Matt Weintraub was caught using DoorDash. No, I don't mean he was using DoorDash to order lunch for his coworkers. No, he was moonlighting as a DoorDash driver while working out of the district attorney's office. Yeah, DoorDash Central. Yeah, no problem. I got your delivery for you right here. Hey, everybody, I gotta step outside real quick. I'll be right back. The Bucks County District Attorney only demoted from his position while the DA called it, quote, an incredibly poor decision. Thank you so much for starry-eyed for throwing out this one. You're fantastic. And the Pennsylvania Capitol is scheduled to reopen this public for the public on Monday. It will reopen for the public for the first time since the fall. Guests must wear masks unless you are Republican legislators who still don't believe in the pandemic. The Commonwealth Foundation went in front of the House Commerce Committee last week and defended their positions on why there shouldn't be the minimum wage. This was astonishing. I got to say, this was unbelievable. Representatives Malcolm Kenyatta and John Galloway shut that nonsense down and forced the Commonwealth Foundation's representative to explain and to say, for the record, that they support a $0 minimum wage. That's right. There should be no floor to the minimum wage. Matter of fact, workers should have to pay employers to work for them just for the privilege. It was unbelievable. It was great. Well, two men were arrested this week for taking part in the assault on Capitol Police Officer Brian Sicknick during the January 6th insurrection. Sicknick died from his injuries. And once again, a Pennsylvanian was one of those arrested. Julian Cater, a 32-year-old man from State College was seen spraying bear spray directly into the face of Officer Sicknick during the assault. There you go, PA. Chalk another one up for being number one. And yes, of course, Senator Pat Toomey, even though he's got nothing to do on his way out the door, he blocked a bill that would have prevented debt collectors from taking stimulus checks. When asked why he voted for the bill, he blamed Democrats for not including it in the original bill. They should have compromised and had the 60 votes for the Republicans, in which case people would be getting zero, right? And he defended debt collectors and said, it's too late anyways, because 90 million checks have already been sent to Americans. Yeah, way to stick up for working families, Toomey. Can't wait till that guy's gone. And at the state Senate budget hearings yesterday, Posse Chancellor Dan Greenstein issued a threat. If his plans for reorganization of the 14 state-owned university systems are not followed, including the mergers of 3 universities in the Northeast and 3 universities in the West, he told lawmakers, quote, I will be recommending to the board that we come back to the Senate next year with a legislative package to dissolve the state system. He was mad. But Senator Joe Pittman of Indiana County, the home of IUP, said he'd be happy to introduce that legislation. ASCAP President Jamie Martin said she was flooded with texts and emails from faculty who were watching the hearings. She said, quote, it was reckless. At the very least, it was reckless, she told Penn Live. In today's last call, NASA finally had a successful test of the Space Launch System, or the SLS rocket, on Thursday. The SLS rocket is the one planned to be NASA's workhorse for the Artemis moon missions and eventually the Mars missions. This thing is like 3 years kind of behind schedule, and there's all sorts of issues that have come up with it. Actually, the Biden administration is going through a review of it right now, a review of the cost of it. So that's going to be interesting. And SpaceX's launch of 60 Starlink internet satellites this week was seen over large areas of the eastern U.S., including central PA and Bucks County. And, of course, there were big sections of kind of Pennsylvania, right, that just happened to overlap with all the nut jobs that went to the insurrection, who looked up and said, "Aliens! Aliens!" Or the second coming. Who the hell knows? Now, some scientists also say that the large amounts of water that flowed on Mars billions of years ago may have actually become trapped in the planet's outer crust. The findings published in the journal Science suggest that between 30% and 99% of the water on Mars may have been incorporated into minerals and buried on the planet's crust, which fundamentally changed the game for future expeditions to Mars. And Elon Musk, right, the perennial and kind of forever man boy, fulfills a childhood dream by changing his official title to, quote, Techno King of Tesla. Yes, and Tesla's chief financial officer, Zach Kirkhorn, will also get a new title. He'll be Tesla's Master of Coin. Frankly, I gotta say, I think it's pretty funny. But anyways, and it's official. I've got my vaccine appointment. That's right. This week, next week, I'm getting my first shot. I can't wait. And this week, Free Will Brewing's got a bunch of releases. The big news this week is on Sunday, as part of their Sour Sunday, they're releasing all of their, what do they call them? The Barrel Age Flower series, like Chamomile and Red Clover and that kind of stuff. They've been slowly letting us know who they're. That's all going to be released this Sunday. I'll give you details about that in today's last call. And they also got Personified. That is a DDH double IPA brewed with a base of flaked oats, wheat, and hopped in a kettle with an old favorite, Simcoe, and then double dry hop with Citra, Azaka, and extra Simcoe for good measure. And that comes in at about 8.4 ABV. I'll give you a little more details about that in today's last call. So there we go. Sean, man, it's been quite a week. I have to say it's a little weird doing kind of the intro without having the music playing behind me at this point, but it is what it is until I kind of get that sorted out. I think we finally got it sorted out before the beginning of the show today, so I appreciate your help in that. But more importantly, how the hell are you, man?
I'm doing pretty good. You know, just another week going here in Harrisburg, having some fun, you know, fucking around, doing nothing, embracing the 0-day work week.
Well, I guess you gotta really pack it in this week, especially if the Capitol is going to open next week.
Oh yeah, I'm looking forward to it. Definitely looking forward to the Capitol reopening next week.
All I got to say is, like, ease into it, Sean. Ease into it. Right? I mean, like, you know, going from the 0-hour work week to actually, I don't know, like a 5 or 10 hour work week is going to be a bit of a challenge. So please.
As much as I hate being in that building, and as much as it's fucking horrible that building is, and you know, I'm really looking forward to it. You know, like, what I'm really looking forward to is seeing the people I was shitposting about the whole entire year. You know, coming out of this pandemic and see, like, you know, I would say burned a few bridges. Well, like, I don't know if they're bridges, if those bridges weren't even there, you know, so yep. More like lobbing missiles at people the whole time, you know, if you follow my Twitter account. But I'm looking forward to the Capitol reopening. I actually kind of miss being in there. You know, I was reading something, like, there was an article over the weekend about, like, brain fog or, like, some sort of term that came up with it. And where people are now, like, so long into the pandemic where, like, they actually forget tasks that they're currently doing at the moment.
Yeah, that's right.
Because we've been stuck inside, like, the whole entire winter.
Yep.
And it's like, I felt like I've hit that point a couple of times, especially, like, recently. But, you know, it's nice that the Capitol is reopening. I actually get to get out of my fucking apartment and do some things. You know, I started running again this past couple of weeks. You know, I've been keeping up with, like, doing some walking and running, and I've noticed that.
I mean, Sean's lifestyle channel has really kind of been, you know, kicking this past couple weeks.
I bought some Patagonia shirts. You know, for the record, I am a Patagonia fan over Fish and Stream, or you know,
the only time I wear Stream.
Field and Stream, whatever it is.
I'm a fan of Patagonia over some other thing that I don't even know the name of.
Well, like, so I was making a joke. Like, I only wear my Field and Stream shirts when I go out and I have to go to, like, right wing events, kind of, like, fit in with the crowd. You know, you got to look the part. You can't just be showing up with, you know, your Adidas shoes and black jeans and shit like that.
Yeah, yeah.
You got to show up with your work jeans, your boots and stuff like that. So, you know, like I like to play both ends of things. But yeah, I also got my taxes together. I'm actually getting someone to do my taxes this year, which is like, is amazing.
Sean's a big boy. Sean is a big boy. I think that's
it. So like, it was actually my friend who is like, does the accounting work for the state party, is an accountant down here in Harrisburg. So I emailed him like, hey, I have a question. You know, I'm looking to do my taxes for the first time and I'm wondering, will I save the money that I'm going to be paying you to do my taxes? And he called me like, that's not how this works. I was trying to get like a cost benefit analysis from him. He's like, this is how this works. I do your taxes because you don't want to. Right,
exactly. And you pay me money for doing that.
And you pay for the service.
Right. Exactly.
So I mean, like it was, but like, you know, I'm having,
like, I just wonder if I could call you up and just kind of like, I don't know, have you on the phone as I'm doing my taxes and ask you questions as they happen.
But no, like, so I filled out like my, the couple of the organizing packets that they sent over. It feels good not wearing have to worry about that. Just write the fucking check when the time comes.
It makes a difference. I mean, I did my taxes up until probably about 3, maybe 4 years ago. It got to the point where I just couldn't, like, the time that was involved and stuff, we couldn't deal with it anymore. Plus with kids and, you know, all that kind of stuff, it was just, I was like, that's it, I'm done.
Well, I mean, like, also, like, now I'm bringing in more money. It's like, I also have, like, new apartment, you know, the tax rules that happened with the COVID relief bills. And then also, like, I have a dedicated office space in my apartment. So it's like, yep. You know, like, there are a bunch of more things I could write off. I actually did not write much off for the past couple of years. So now I have, like, all my expenses logged, you know, and there's things that I care about doing.
Yeah.
So, no, I mean, it's also, like, I don't want to get hit with penalties that I have to pay and all that shit. So, you know, it's good. It's good. Life is good.
Life in Harrisburg, spring is here. I'm telling you.
Nature's returning.
Well, not to have too much of a 180 degree transition here from life is good. It's been, you know, a kind of really kind of insane week, right? In some ways. I mean, there's been, you know, it's been one of these, which I'm beginning to, I think, settle into as a way of kind of my body, at least, is settling into becoming familiar with this pattern of having both really hopeful things happen and then really, really bad shit happen at the same time. So, I mean, this, you know, these killings that were, that took place in Atlanta at the, you know, at these spas, which were, I mean, whatever. I mean, I understand why kind of like officials would say, we don't know for sure if it was like, but I'm like, whatever. I mean, this is clearly, I mean, as
I mean, like it should have been like a two sentence, like a two, like a two, like they, yeah, like this police officer should never have said what he said at this press conference. Probably should have just kept it at like, we're still investigating and that's it, you know, not giving excuses for the killer. You know, I mean, a couple of things, like, you know, I'm not like, this is a horrific tragedy, but like, I mean, like, what else do you expect after, you know, Republicans and Trump spent the whole entire year calling it Kung Flu, the China virus.
Right, exactly.
Like, and, you know, like, we've seen these attacks against Asian Americans, you know, on the rise. A couple of reports came out within the past, like, 2 weeks or 3 weeks about, you know, it's at epidemic levels, the attacks against the Asian American communities. You know, it almost reminds me to what we see after 9/11 against the Muslim American community.
It's exactly.
And the attacks like that happened there. And, you know, I've had friends who I have a couple of friends who are Iranian. One of my friends is a journalist out here in Harrisburg. His family's from Iran. He's from the Western, you know, out in Arizona. And, you know, he was talking, he spent a couple of times talking about like what it was like being an Iranian in America after 9/11 and what happened to his father and his family and himself and stuff like that. And I mean, it's, you know, it's like, I guess back on that, I mean, we're now at a point where the people voting weren't alive for 9/11 or what happened afterwards.
Right.
Like this younger generation. And it's just like it, you know, I clearly remember 9/11 and like what happened to Muslim American and, you know, Sikh communities afterwards and what continued to happen. And, you know, I feel like this is going to last a lot longer than, you know, the coronavirus itself. You know, well, like here's, even locally.
Yeah. No. I mean, I think that's right. And I've told this story before on the podcast, but I mean, I was teaching during 9/11. I was teaching at George Mason University. And George Mason is in Fairfax County, Virginia, which is one of the most diverse counties actually kind of in the country. Right. And part of that has to do with a lot of kind of, you know, international families that are, you know, living in D.C. That's where they have homes. A lot of folks that are, you know, represent. But there's just a lot of immigration to the area, too, as well. So it's this really rich, diverse. It's like the most diverse student body I've ever taught. And students are great. Anything, whatever. But so shortly after the beginning of the semester is when 9/11 happened, and a good chunk of my students and that, like probably a third of my students in class were Muslim. And the day when we kind of returned to campus, you know, there was a bunch of students missing. And then the following week when they kind of came back, we just kind of talked about what was going on. And, you know, there was, you know, some of these students were literally thrown off buses. Right. Because especially and particularly women like who had the hijab, who wore the hijab, and were thrown off buses and were kind of like spit at. There were, you know, people's families, you know, who owned restaurants and things like this, had their windows broken. So that all happened in 9/11. And right now, one of the things that I think is distinct here is that because it wasn't this like one event. Right. That channeled everything. It was this persistent, ongoing ramping up of racism. Right. Especially once we got to the pandemic, that it took, I think, a while. And, you know, a lot of people have been pointing this out. Helen Jim down in, you know, in Philly has been pointing this out. I've been kind of reading.
Nikhil Saval spoke
in the Senate floor. What, yesterday. Or
I mean, he Wednesday? Was interrupted Wednesday. He was interrupted by Senator Chris Dush. You know, for his views and being, you know, part of the AAPI community. Nikhil mm-hmm. Saval was also, a victim of a hate crime, you know, back in 2016 in Fishtown. You know, like he lives in South Philadelphia. You know, like it's you had the Senate Republicans coming out on their campaign committee account, like blasting Democrats for speaking out against this and pinning the blame on Republicans. And yes, absolutely. The blame goes on Republicans for this. You know, do we know? I'm really interested in seeing what this person has on his computer, right. Or what he's written down on social media accounts. I'm interested in, like, you know, I wouldn't be surprised if he went to reopen or stop the steal rallies over the past year. Georgia, Atlanta was a hotbed for this,
right.
For the stop the steal stuff. You know, so is Pennsylvania. And like you have Republicans up here like Scott Perry, you know, consistently calling it the China virus or the China flu and stuff like that. Like, you know, this racism runs through the Republican Party. Even yesterday or 2 days ago, Chip Roy compared
right.
the lynching. Like
that was
unapologetically
that blew my mind.
I mean, this is the Republican Party that we have now. Like this is not like there are no more moderates left. Like even the Charlie Dents who were conservative firebrands when they were in office. You know, like even Charlie Dent, like would never fucking say anything like that. Like, you know what I mean?
Well, I know. I mean, we're really talking about things have gone off the edge, but you know, the other part of this too is, you know, I really appreciate it. And I put this in the show notes. I didn't mention this at the intro, but, Helen Jim had this, Twitter thread. I think it was from yesterday. That was phenomenal. I'll link it in the show notes here, but she talks about the history of the kind of AAPI movement in Philadelphia, her own involvement, but kind of, you know, going back to the 60s and or kind of 1973, like the first image that she's got in this Twitter thread is like a 1973 Chinatown activist block bulldozers that would have turned 10th Street into I-676 off ramp and forced the Vine Street Expressway underground. Right. And that was like a picture from the New York Times. And I love the fact that she's showing these images of Asian resistance and Asian organizing that I don't think gets the same. Well, no, I just don't think I know does not get the exposure and focus that a lot of other social movements have. And, you know, part of that has to do with, you know, I've been reading a lot from the kind of from Asian communities and organizers and talking about, you know, this myth of the model minority has also been, you know, utilized as a way to kind of separate out like the racism targeting kind of Asian or the AAPI community and AAPI organizing from African-American struggles and from Latinx struggles. And so do check out that Twitter thread. I think it's worth the, you know, it's worth the time going through that. I read it this morning and I was like, man, it's like, I literally had no idea of this history. And
I remember like Vox with a V, they mm-hmm. have a video on their YouTube channel, maybe within the past year or two, about in Los Angeles, you know, the histories of the anti-Asian American history in, you know, like Los Angeles, where they completely leveled a neighborhood back in the 60s and 70s in order to put a shopping district in there, yeah. You know, like a commercial district. I think it was like Filipino Town or Filipina Town or something like that. You know, and then like last week I was watching a video like Vosh put up on his channel talking about like the riots in 1992, the Rodney King riots. And it's like, you know, like the, you know, where they specifically forced the riots to go away from the white communities, you know, and pushed them into the Asian American communities.
Right.
And like that only heightened, you know, instead of like trying to quell the riots were pushed away from, made sure like the white areas of Los Angeles were protected. And, you know, the riots naturally diffused, filtered out somewhere else. And they went to the Asian American communities. And that's where you have like, you know, like a lot of the animosity, you know, between the two organizations, and like you get that model minority myth and stuff like that. You know, I was also watching a video yesterday. There's a Southern YouTuber, Bo is Beautiful, like from Louisiana. Like, so he has like that Bayou accent, mm-hmm. basically talking about like detailing the 150 years, 200 years of like Asian American discrimination in this country.
Yeah.
And how it pretty much like, you know, it was happening on the West Coast. You know, we never talked about it here. We never heard about it, but it was pretty much like the same model of segregation in the South. And basically it's like, this is America.
Right.
Like this is America. This is who we are. This is who we've always been.
Well, you know, like, and I think about this, this is like such an important moment to, you know, again, to kind of, like you said, this is America, to even kind of further expand how we see our history, right? And again, an opportunity once again, especially for the left, right, to kind of internalize this, you know, this narrative and listen a lot right now, listen and kind of read about what's going on. And then, you know, again, you know, this model of intersectionality where we're kind of looking at these kind of ways of kind of acting in solidarity, that is not saying we're all the same, but try to understanding kind of these other histories. And I for one, certainly, you know, am kind of well aware of how much I need to learn right now. And, you know, thank God that there's this absolutely amazing kind of activist kind of in the AAPI community and people and journalists who are kind of writing, kind of responding to this so that that we can make sure that this doesn't kind of go by the wayside. I mean, you know,
I think Pennsylvania has its first AAPI nonprofit that started last year, a C4 organization. My friend Mohan is directing it. This is something that he wanted to start. I mean, we were talking about this when he was out in Harrisburg a couple years ago. He used to work for Department of State, I believe. Mm-hmm. And he was talking about like starting a PAC specifically for AAPI issues in Pennsylvania. And this was like 2 or 3 years ago. And there's, you know, like, and this is something that he moved to Philadelphia. And this is a project that he's working on in Philadelphia. And it's like, you know, it's amazing seeing how far that's come. And it's also seeing others like Nikhil Saval, who's, you know, I would say Indian or South Asian, you know, how there's other different races within that community getting together. And all because it's like it's a complex group.
Right, exactly.
It's, you know, it's not just like, you know, Japanese or Chinese or Korean Americans. It's, you know, Indian and Middle Eastern and you know, Pakistani Americans that are also involved with this.
Well, and this is like Helen Gim, but and she's talking about the history of the Asian Americans United in Philadelphia, which goes back to like the 1970s. And 80 where, you know, and her own kind of involvement with that beginning back in the 1990s, you know, and again, to see that there's an organized, like, you know, not just an organization, right, that has been doing this kind of organizing the community, right, for these periods of time, but also, you know, a kind of a clear sense of history. Like I've just been going and looking through some of their archives. I mean, you can check that out at aaunited.org. They've got a great section on their history there, talking about their work and their background, how to get involved, contact, ways to donate to the organization. And now is a great time to kind of do check them out. Because, what happened in, you know, in these killings in Atlanta, you know, as people have been pointing out now for a while, this is part of, you know, this explosion of racism that was, you know, it didn't start with Trump, right? But Trump certainly kind of like fanned the flames. And we see all these rise of kind of white supremacy. We see the rise of these alt-right movements and far-right movements, which is why, you know, we've got to kind of deal with this. And like, you know, once again, it's like, this is the perfect example of why kind of like ignoring kind of the examples of these kind of right-wing movements as a strategy to kind of like dealing with them just doesn't work. And, you know, I'm thinking of this, the example that, you know, you were kind of bringing up today about the Proud Boys, kind of what was going on here is like, that was precisely what we saw. The Proud Boys were kind of dismissed by kind of mainstream politics and mainstream folks. You don't pay attention to them. They're really kind of a fringe group. Ignore them and they'll go away, right?
Yeah, and yeah, you know, we saw 4 more Proud Boys get arrested this week. One of them was Zach Rell, the leader of the Philadelphia Proud Boys, you know, who was outed a couple weeks ago in the Philadelphia Inquirer, and he was finally arrested. You know, everyone was talking about this since the insurrection. Rell was photographed, like, leading the charge, like, you know, video, like, all the videos, all the photos coming out of the Proud Boys. You saw this guy leading the charge. You know, I'm talking to local activists. Rell's expecting having his firstborn kid. So you got to think, like, he is probably going to be flipping on people pretty soon, you know, you'd expect that. But I mean, like, you saw Zach Rell profiled as someone who was hanging out with the police officers, you know, with Mike Pence. He was drinking the FOP lodge. There was plenty of like content going around on social media where Rell is tipping off the feds on anti-fascist researchers, where they tip off the Philadelphia Police Department or other police departments on their marches and to tell them where they're going. You know, like, they took a really like professional approach to it as like a legitimate organization when, like, no, they're just a bunch of white nationalists walking around. And I mean, like, there's a story in the New York Times that we have linked in here, and it's pretty much like a couple stories in the New York Times, but like the one like where they just ignored the Proud Boys for 4 years and everyone was like, I mean, it's not news to us. The right people, like, you know, like, you know, and it, you know, reminds me of like, this is the type of shit that, like, you know, unionists happen in Northern Ireland, like during the Troubles and stuff. That's like right. That. Or like, you know, or any other like fascist like regime over the past like 50 years. You know, it shouldn't be a surprise that the law enforcement in these countries, various countries in Northern Ireland or United States or Latin America, turn a blind eye to these organizations and these white nationalist movements or these fascists. Yep. And it's pretty much what happened here.
Yeah. So, I mean,
yeah, I wouldn't be surprised if, and also the cop who was giving the excuses, well, Jesus, like, that's Christ. Not surprised. That's not surprising. I mean, like, right, as soon as he said it, I put a thing out on Twitter, on Facebook, you know, watch this guy be a fucking Klan member. And literally this story comes out like hours later. Like, exactly. I mean, like, it's not surprising. This is what like our law enforcement is.
Right. And we've seen reporting over the past several years now where, you know, when people finally started paying attention, you know, during the Trump administration to the rise of this kind of white supremacy stuff and kind of pointing out the fact that, you know, there have been like attempts to recruit from these kind of white supremacists and white nationalist communities in police departments and in even in some places in the military. Right now, the military right now is trying to kind of find ways of kind of ferreting that stuff out. Right. But, you know, you got a lot of work to undo there, but that's not the case when it comes to police departments, right? Who that are, you know, they're not federalized, right? They're all kind of the conglomerations in all these different areas. So you have some of these police departments, you know, as we saw in the insurrection, sending, you know, like active duty police officers
or we saw
to go
like
break into
in
the Capitol.
Philadelphia over the summer. You saw police officers allowing these Proud Boys or these mobs going around attacking people in Fishtown or South Philly. And not doing anything and blaming the protesters versus like going after the mob
right.
for attacking people with fucking baseball bats and shit like that or pipes. Like, you know, like, yeah, I mean, it's just like, it's not surprising that this happened.
No, it's not.
As horrible as it sounds, no, it's not surprising. I mean, like, you know, it's like there's a whole entire, cops and Klan go hand in hand. Like, it's pretty much like, an age-old like saying.
Yep, absolutely, 100%. In better news, however, on the other side of things, I mean, like this is what I mean about these really horrible things happening at the same time as seeing these really good things. I mean, Deb Haaland being confirmed as the first Native American cabinet secretary this week, I thought was absolutely huge. You know, if you think about the history of, you know, here's like the exact opposite of what you see in that what took place in Atlanta. And what that cop said, like here you have the very, you know, the agency of the federal government that has been responsible for so much of the kind of like oppression and exploitation of kind of indigenous lands, indigenous people, the Department of the Interior, particularly the Bureau of Indian Affairs. And now you have Deb Haaland like is going to lead that agency. And I have to say with a full-throated endorsement from kind of like indigenous communities all over the country, right? And a full-throated endorsement from Biden, right? So, and progressive communities. I mean, this seems to be like a win across the board. And especially when you hear what Joe Biden has said about her nomination, when he's been asked about it, he's like, she's going to be able to do amazing things. I mean, you get the sense at this point. Now, obviously, we're going to have to watch it and see what goes on because obviously there's a lot of oil and gas industry, which has been part of that. Mining industries, which have kind of intersect right over here. It seems at this point, Biden seems to want her in that position to do things to rectify some of the past wrongs that have going on. I mean, obviously, that's a tall order. But I think that's a huge thing. So in the midst of this kind of like, you know, horror, you also have like the countervailing force, right? And I don't want to say that these are equals in countervailing forces, but that's a pretty substantial win in my mind.
Yeah.
So let's talk a little bit about, you know, there's a bunch of stuff we could talk about, but I really think we focus on a couple things for the rest of the first sector. One, I'd like to dig in a little bit on this filibuster stuff. Do you think where this seems to be going? And just to touch on the stuff around the 4-day work week, and then I want to talk about the graduate student unions. And obviously, if you have other things you want to throw in there too as well, it'd be great. But so give me your take on what's happening right now with the filibuster. I mean, it seems to be that this is going to be kind of front and center.
The train's leaving.
Yeah, that's what it seems like to me, right?
I feel like the train's leaving the station. It feels like Manchin's the only one like holding us up at the moment, but he said last week he was open and changing the rules about it. You know, even if the filibuster is reformed to where they have to speak on the Senate floor and can't leave, mm-hmm. I feel like that's a huge victory.
Totally.
Like, to force them to speak and outplay the other side. You know, like, we have to reform this filibuster, and the fact I feel like it's going to happen. I think it's going to happen. I don't think like, I mean, I don't know how you can be Joe Manchin or Sinema at this time. And, you know, this regressive caucus of the Democratic Party and still support the filibuster after if the Republicans are going to abuse it to the point where nothing gets done. You know, like, Democrats have to get shit done by 2022 in order to win, keep the House and Senate.
Right.
Like, I mean, like, that's just fact. Like, you know what I mean? Like,
if we
want to win, we're going to have to get shit done. And getting shit done means we're going to have to reform the filibuster. Like, you know, like, are you going to let voting rights go to the wayside because after this onslaught of, you know, like states taking up like anti-voter rolls or anti-voting bills, are you going to like let that go to the wayside because you want to protect this arcane rule in the institution? Like there are some people like Democrats saying if it wasn't for the filibuster, like Planned Parenthood wouldn't be around today, which is just fucking bullshit. Like,
right.
I mean, like how much of an, how are you going to let Mitch McConnell dictate the rules of the game when you have the power?
Well, this is the thing,
with
right?
One vote.
Right. So let's
50 plus one.
Let's just say this, right? So, you know, here's, I've heard that argument, like about say Planned Parenthood and some, you know, kind of other legislation that would they said that would have been true, like if we didn't have the filibuster. But there's one big significant difference now, right? Is that we've seen such an incredible demographic shift, like over the past several, like, you know, couple decades, right? Few decades now, where is that Democrat, and that coupled with the kind of intense gerrymandering efforts on the part of the Republican Party, so that you see that the gap between like the party, like, so we have a 50-50 split in the Senate right now, is like Democrats like represent, I can't remember the exact figure, it's like almost like 10 million kind of more Americans or something like this than I might even be undercounting that than Republicans do in that 50-50 split, because, you know, places like say Montana, right, have the same number of votes too than places like, like
Pennsylvania or California
or New York, right? And, you know, if you look at Washington, D.C., right now there's proposals that are going to hit the floor for discussion this week about D.C. statehood, right? Like Washington, D.C., that small little space, Washington, D.C., has a larger population than a lot of these Western states, like Wyoming, like Montana, like Idaho. Right. But they don't have any representation, while as these states out there, right, because they're primarily white states, right, they're primarily small states, they get to kind of two Senate votes. So things like that are kind of in the mix here. So I think that's a big game changer because of what.
And also, I feel like.
Go ahead. Sorry.
This train's leaving the station simply because progressive activists.
That's exactly where I was going.
Yeah.
Right? Exactly.
And like you hear what Biden is doing, I feel like Biden is just sticking his finger in his tongue and seeing which way the wind's blowing.
Yeah.
Like
it's like ripping up some grass, throwing it in the air. Like, where's
like, I mean, like, which is not something that we thought would have happened a couple years ago. Now, granted, like, I'm not going to say Biden's going to be the end all be all of everything, but like, it sounds like he's more receptive to the Democratic base and where the progressive politics are going, and where the base of the Democratic Party is going versus the concerns of the Mitch McConnell. I remember like on our, we have, you know, strategy calls every week with, you know, different organizations in the progressive movement. And, you know, one of the calls, pretty much like after the Biden got elected was the Biden administration has said that we need to keep the pressure on them to get things done.
Right. Exactly.
Like they are asking for the pressure to be put on them. So, I mean, like, and reforming the filibuster will, like, do a lot of things. You know, you want voting rights in this country to stay around. You, like, I mean, like, the play is, like, do you want a fascist authoritarian government to be in place because you didn't reform a fucking filibuster rule?
Right. And you know, I don't want to try to make this like too abstract, but I do think, and, you know, people have been saying this now for a while, but I do think this is, the real question is here is like, do we want a democracy or not? Right. And recognizing, yes, we're a democratic republic. We're not a kind of director. I get all that stuff, but that is really at stake here. And I think that this, you know, the HB1, right. You know, the legislation of the Voting Rights Act is kind of coming forward. That puts it right on the front of the table. Are you going to allow, right, a minority government, i.e., you know, the Republicans, to block, right, people's right to vote? I mean, we're talking about, do we want to move in the direction back towards Jim Crow, or do we want to move towards an expansive kind of multicultural democracy? That is really what's at stake right now. And I think that, you know, as that bill makes its way into the Senate, right, and I recognize that, you know, there's been questions about what bill is going to come up next, and Chuck Schumer has got all freaking hot on the China shit, which I think what's been happening this week is probably going to put that on the back burner, but we shall see. There were just talks in Alaska that didn't go so great, but Anyways, I think that that kind of puts it on the on front and center. And I think this is actually, to you know, to your point, this is in the wheelhouse of progressive movements, right? This is what the, and organized progressive movements have been arguing. And the difference is that now, you know, progressives are actually organized, right? So,
yeah.
Cool, man. Well, I, you know, I know this this wouldn't affect you that much, but I think that for the rest of us, the fact that Spain is looking to pilot this 4-day work week is pretty freaking awesome.
So I actually will, full disclosure, when I was working over the summer at and when I was in college working at LaSalle University, we had 4-day work weeks in the summertime. Mm-hmm. You know, like there were 10-hour days, still did the 40-hour work week. But, you know, I preferred the 4 10-hour days, you know, like doing maintenance work versus a 5-day, like having that extra day off doesn't make a huge difference.
Well, and imagine this, right? And imagine the fact if you,
I mean, I would love a 20-hour work week.
But no, well, I mean, I know, well, I mean, God, I mean, now like 20-hour work week looks like, you know, freaking indentured servitude for you. I know, but, but, you know, it's like, but imagine that 4-day work week, except instead of being 10-hour days, being 8-hour days, right? I mean, that's the
key. Or 6-hour days.
Well, yeah. But I mean, in the Spanish case, right? You're saying you're still, you've got your, you're literally not just condensing a 40-hour work week into 4 days. You're actually keeping the day limits, right? And eliminating one day. So every weekend becomes a 3-day weekend, basically, right?
It's always a 3-day weekend.
Well, look, the vast majority of people in the freaking world don't have your job, okay? and I say job very generously, okay? Just kidding. But the that's a real game changer. And one aspect that they didn't mention, at least I'll be honest, I didn't read the absolute full article. I made it about halfway through, and I was reading it kind of late last night. But I didn't go through the links in the reports that were coming up, but I know that in the past, one of the, both France has dealt with this. France moved from a work week down to a 38-hour work week, down to 32-hour work week at one point. Spain is now doing this here. And
I feel like you get more employment too.
No, that's what I was about to say, is that one of the proposals has been about, okay, what does this do? Is that one, as long as you can ensure, right, that it's built in, that you're not talking about lowering people's salaries, right? You're keeping you move it to a 4-day work week at the same salary. And then you have businesses, for example, that, so, well, you know, if there's businesses that say, oh my God, you know, but we still have work left to do that, we need the 40 hours, then that puts businesses in a position where they're going to hire more people. Right. So it actually helps with kind of unemployment issues. And I know that's been an issue in Spain. I mean, the unemployment rate in Spain is pretty high right now. And they've been impacted, you know, part of that has to do with like how they've been really kind of wrecked by the coronavirus and a whole bunch of stuff like this. But that is actually a kind of a jobs program as well, because it could eliminate some of the bullshit work you've got to do. Kind of like you said, Sean, is like, it doesn't make a huge difference, right? You know, if you have to stretch out your workday just to be there, right? When really efficiency dictates that, no, you know, you don't need to be there anymore. Then a whole bunch of the bullshit stuff, which kind of like saps our time and our energy and our sanity, is gone, right? Not all of it, of course. And basically what that does is that gives back to the worker the efficiencies that have been attributed in those jobs, right? One of the things that I know, the Economic Policy Institute puts out this study where they track not just kind of like the minimum wage or kind of the medium wage over time based on inflation, but also looking at the wage in relationship to productivity gains, right? So if you just track the minimum wage, right, from say, I don't know, 1968 or 1970 or something to now, right? It's like our minimum wage, $7.25 an hour or whatever. It should be kind of above 12 hours at the very, very minimum, the most conservative estimates, right? It's really supposed to be higher than that. If, however, you tack that to productivity, for over a long time, those wages move together, right? Productivity gains and wage gains kind of move together. If you put those things together and say workers should be kind of like, you know, again, get some of those productivity rewards in their paycheck, then the wage would be kind of over $20 an hour, right? Which is the case in kind of most European countries, right? So that's kind of the idea here, right? This, not only do you kind of deal with getting rid of the bullshit in the jobs, right? Not only do you actually kind of like, you know, kind of reward, you know, kind of workers and give workers more free time, but you're also kind of correcting, right, this kind of this gap between productivity and wages. So, I mean, it's I'm fascinated by it, and I'm really curious to see what's going to come out of it.
Oh, yeah, same here.
But here, yeah, and I understand. I can't remember where it was. I was trying to locate it before we went on the air today. But I know that they've been toying around someplace in the U.S. To try and do this. Probably someplace in California would be my guess. But or there was something, maybe even Washington State was toying around with this. I'm not quite sure.
I know some like state workers in Pennsylvania tried getting a. I was talking to Chris Ellis about this, and he was mentioning in our Twitter group, our shitposting group, that. that like their union 668 tried to bargain for 4-day work week, and I think like the executive directors like just shot it down immediately. So I mean, like, there are unions that are bargaining for that stuff here in Pennsylvania.
Yep, absolutely. And I think that's you know, that's a good goal. And again, we've talked about this on the show before too, as well, as that, you know, once you see things are possible, once people start getting these victories, right? If you go way back when, you know, when we interviewed Noam Chomsky, right? Kind of like back in the day, right after Raging Chicken.
10 years ago.
I mean, seriously, we first got started, right? When Raging Chicken was first started, we landed an interview with Noam Chomsky. And that's one of the things he said, is that those victories, right, part of organizing and part of being organized is achieving victories and having the experience, the collective experience of the win, right? And then once you do that, you break through, you start thinking about other possibilities, right? And you build confidence as a people, as a movement. And I think that is something that is happening right now. So something like this, a 4-day work week might have been absolutely unthinkable and laughed out of the room, you know, even like 3 years ago. At this point, people are like, you know what? You know, I know this is true for me. It's like, you know, as much as I cannot stand online teaching, I'll tell you, there's parts of my life that got a lot better for not having to deal with all the absolute bullshit that I have to do with it on a daily basis, right? And that's reoriented my brain a bit, right, about what I'm willing to do, right? And I've heard stories of this over and over and over again from people across, you know, across different job sectors, right? So we shall see. We shall see. Last thing I want to kind of throw on the table is right now is a great opportunity to go check out the folks over at the Graduate Student Workers of Columbia University. They are on strike. This is one of the most important graduate union fights kind of in the country. Why do I say that? Well, because they've been at the forefront of a bunch of NLRB rulings about the ability, whether or not graduate student workers at private universities have the right to organize, right? There's different laws, and it's a different ruling based from, say, public and private sector, right? Public sector workers, right? Graduate students have the right to organize. That is not necessarily the truth, or that is not the truth in the private sector, right? Now, a private sector employer could choose to recognize a union, right? But in most cases, they fight it. In places like Columbia University, NYU University, right? NYU, I'm sorry, and Yale University have been some of the kind of key ones that we've seen kind of come up in a bunch of these decisions. And right now, after they won their contract at Columbia University, or I'm sorry, they won the contract, they won their election, right? They won recognition, but it's been about 2 years since they've been able to kind of win negotiating, and they still do not have their first contract, which I should say, the PRO Act, right, which is kind of making its way through Congress right now, the PRO Act would basically require, right, that once recognition is achieved, that there's bargaining. And if there's not bargaining, a third party will come in to kind of arbitrate this. And that's one of the things that these graduate student workers are calling for. There's one other thing that I did not mention. If you look at their breakdown on their website, which I have linked in our show notes today, they're looking for neutral third party arbitration, like I was kind of mentioning just then. They want this $4,000 increase around there in stipends and summer funding over the next 3 years, and increases for both hourly and salary salaried workers that move close to a living wage. They want a recognition for the full unit, that is undergraduate workers, MA workers, and PhD workers, right? They want that all part of that same unit. They want a union shop. That idea is that, you know, that you're a closed shop, right? It's that the union gets here, everybody's either got to be a member of the union or has to pay their fair share for dealing with the contract, negotiating the contract. And finally, you want a healthcare fund of $250,000 per year and partial coverage of dental premiums for PhD workers. So there's that, but there's another thing that has been integral part of it. And I don't know what exactly the status is now, but most recently, this is at the beginning of the week when I was reading about this. The graduate student workers at Columbia do not want to include a no strike clause in their contract, right? Because they don't trust the administration at this point. So they're like, nope, we're not going to include. Usually what has happened in union contracts is basically say, okay, as part of the agreement of this negotiation, you agree as a union not to strike in the terms of the contract. Now, some unions have never, ever allowed that, right? If you look at the longshore workers, right, they're like, they'll laugh you out of the room if you want to take away their strike clause. That's also true in some Teamster locals, right? So that has been kind of some of the things. But what's more the norm is to kind of give that up. And these workers are saying, nope, you know what? We want to keep the right to strike, which is a really interesting aspect of this fight right now that I kind of want to dig into a little bit more. I'm going to reach out to some of these folks. I want to see if I can get some of these people on Out to Coop Live one of these weeks. So we shall see. But definitely go to their website. They're collecting donations. They're kind of looking for kind of solidarity help. They can use kind of like Signal Boost in social media. Go check them out. Graduate Student Workers at Columbia University. You can check out their webpage. I'll give it to you real quick. It's just ColumbiaGradUnion.org. That's ColumbiaGradUnion.org. Or you can click the link in the show notes and head on over there. Look at how you can get involved. Even if that is virtually, if you're not in the New York area, it's just a great way to reach out and support this fight, because I'll tell you, this is the kind of fight that is going to have reverberations kind of across the country, and is going to be one of these fights that is going to test the Biden administration's commitment to labor. So get behind these folks. All right, anything else you want to throw in for the first segment today, Sean?
No, that's pretty much it.
Sounds good to me. All right. So this is Kevin Mahoney, editor and founder of Raging Chicken. Want to remind you that you can help support the show by going to patreon.com/RC Press. We'll be back right after this quick break. Oops, I hit the wrong one. Here we go. My bad.
I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in 2. On this day in labor history, the year was 1917. That was the day the United States Supreme Court upheld the Adamson Act. The act had initially been passed and signed into law the previous September to avoid a nationwide railway strike. It established the 8-hour workday and overtime pay for interstate railroad workers. The four railroad brotherhoods, the engineers, firemen, brakemen, and conductors, had been pushing for these terms since at least 1915. When the railroads refused to budge, the unions prepared to strike. It was the first federal law that sought to determine minimum wages and maximum hours for private industry. The railroads were furious with President Woodrow Wilson for demanding quick passage of the law. They filed the case Wilson versus New, which challenged the constitutionality of the act. The railroads refused to abide by the new law while they waited for their case to be heard, ultimately by the U.S. Supreme Court. The four railroad brotherhoods grew tired of waiting and organized for another strike. The court rejected the railroad's claim and upheld the act. President Wilson had hoped to ensure labor peace as the United States was on the cusp of entering World War I. Seen as a powerful victory for the unions, the railway employees pressed for similar demands. When the industry looked as though it was headed for yet another strike, President Wilson exercised the Army Appropriations Act and issued an executive order at the end of 1917 that placed the railroads under federal control. This nationalized the railroad industry into three divisions under the newly established United States Railroad Administration between the years of 1917 and 1920. Labor History in 2 brought to you by the Illinois Labor History Society and the Rick Smith Show. For more information, go to laborhistoryin2.com.
Welcome back. This is Kevin Mahoney, editor and founder of Raging Chicken. Yes, here once again with Sean Kitchen. We're talking about all the kind of glorious stuff going on right here in PA. And Sean, there is not a more glorious, fun story than kind of our top one here at Tuda's Way. So take us into the world of DoorDash.
Yeah, this was sent to us, sent to me yesterday by one of our newer followers. So thank you for this tip. Starry-eyed, I believe is their
Twitter handle.
Yeah. Yes. Yes. Starry-eyed JGC. Basically, like, the district attorney, the assistant district attorney in Bucks County, your neck of the woods.
Indeed.
Was caught moonlighting as a DoorDash driver while working on county time in the district attorney's office. And he was only demoted for this when the DA called it an incredibly poor decision. Apparently, like, this guy probably makes about $125,000 to $150,000 a year, has a wife, couple kids, and felt the need to DoorDash. So
looking for a side hustle.
Yeah, I mean, like, I don't know how this isn't illegal, you know, like theft of public services, like, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like,
yeah.
I mean,
and so he was doing this during his hours.
Yes, during office hours, apparently. Yes.
Gotta love it. Hey, like, guys, I gotta go for a little bit of a break. I just gotta run out for a minute. I'll be right back.
Yeah. So I mean.
So okay. So here's the thing. This is what I was laughing so much about this ahead of time, because when Sean first told me about it, I said, guys, you know, say, you know, for using DoorDash kind of during kind of office hours, and I'm thinking, like, what's the problem with that? I mean, you know, so he's calling out for lunch for the office or himself or whatever. I don't see why that's a problem. And Sean's like, no. He was driving for DoorDash. Right? I'm like, oh my God, are you kidding me? That's just insane. That is insane.
So KYW broke this news yesterday. There's a link to the tweets in there with that, but I thought it was a good, fun little story to start off with.
Oh, indeed. And like, look, I mean, we're going to have, you know, I've mentioned, you know, and I'm sorry.
I mean, this is like a fireable offense for like anyone else in the world. Like, you know what I mean? I guess he was just having a bad day and he needed to like start like driving around. I mean, I don't want to like, you know, get into this guy's personal finances and make fun of him for that. But like, what the fuck are you doing?
Well, I'm telling you, this is I'm very excited. This is like, you know, there's a lot of cool stuff happening in Bucks County right now, and the fact that things like this are coming out, I think even more. This is one reason. It's like a shout out once again, even though I'm probably going to butcher your name, Cyril, but Cyril Michalejko, hopefully that's close. He's got the new column. He's got a new column with the Bucks County Courier and the Intelligencer, kind of clear progressive voice. I'm actually going to be talking to him a little bit later on today, not on air. We're gonna go back and forth and some things.
So, like, one of the funny things about
but
Cyril,
he's, but I think
Cyril.
Well, let me just say that, and I so and I think that, you know, Bucks County is at this point where you're some major things are happening. One, you're seeing a deepening of some of these kind of conspiratorial kind of elements within the Republican Party in the county. At the same time, you've got a rise of kind of progressive politics in the state. So it's a good timing for him here. So anyways, go ahead. Sorry.
I was actually kind of floored last week when you were mentioning Cyril by name. You know, I've known of him. I don't think we've ever met in person, but like, you know, we were talking like online going back to like the Occupy Philly days.
Yeah, no, same here. I mean, I first met him like online, and it just actually turns out that one of my wife's good friends actually kind of grew up with him. And like, she's like, after I saw his stuff, I'm, whoa, and she's like, hey, by the way, my friend Cyril from way back is, you know, has got this job. I'm like, no kidding him. So I, you know, reached out to him.
I thought for like the longest time he was doing stuff abroad, like doing different, like teaching down in like South America and stuff like that.
Yep, exactly.
When you mentioned his name, it kind of like clicked like right away. Like, oh wait, like I thought this guy was, I thought Cyril was living abroad doing stuff abroad, but it's great seeing him back in the area.
Absolutely.
You know, he gave us a shout out, in his first, newsletter, us like PA Spotlight, PA Stands Up, Make the Road Pennsylvania. You know, I'm looking forward to seeing what he has to write, with his newsletter over the coming weeks and months and stuff like that. So should be fun.
Yeah, I'm personally happy about this too as well, because in his opening, his very first piece, right? It's the first time I've ever seen someone coming out as directly kind of challenging the kind of like all hail Brian Fitzpatrick garbage that goes on in our county. So I'm very, very thrilled about that, that we're going to see some, finally, we're going to get some kind of real pressure being put on Fitzpatrick kind of in this county.
Cowboy sympathizer.
And oh yeah, and open up the discussion, which I think is going to have, you know, it's going to have ramifications for, you know, some of Fitzpatrick's traditional supporters, right? Particularly those, you've heard me talk about this before on this podcast, where, you know, kind of within the labor movement that I have not been exactly happy about. But, you know, so I think there's going to be kind of an increase in kind of a rethinking about where we want this county to go. But I digress. So, but at this kind of story too about, you know, a dude working for DoorDash, I think is going to be increasingly more difficult for these folks to get away with. So,
yeah. I mean, it's like also the basic boilerplate Republican corruption you see in county and municipal governments pretty much like around the state. So it'll be interesting. You know, this, it isn't just Bucks County, but it's also everywhere else.
Yep.
Like this type of like small town, small government corruption from the Republican Party and yep. the institutions that they control.
Absolutely. So, but good news for you, I guess. You mentioned this at the top of the show. You got the Capitol is going to be opening. And apparently, I know that you're a little bummed that you're going to have to wear a mask and stuff. But
I have to go back to work.
And you've got to actually kind of get up in the morning and kind of and get back to work. And not just get on a phone call, but actually like leave the house and stuff. It's like, and not just leave the house to go get coffee or for the freshest meat that you're going to use that day in your cooking experiments for your lifestyle channel, but actually go to the Capitol. But
hey,
but,
you don't like seriously. my cooking?
Oh, freaking, I love it, man. That's why I'm a follower of the Sean Kitchen Lifestyle channel, right? Right into Kitchen with Kitchen, man. It's great. I love it.
So. You know, it's fun things you see when you stumble onto the Capitol, you know, like things you come across, you know, have a little fun thing. You know, if you look on my, I guess we were going back and forth. But I guess if you look at my Instagram account, you know, I came across a very weird meeting on Monday. And I'm looking to follow up and hoping I see them again this Monday coming up. Pretty much, you know, has to deal with the Jericho marches and the Christian people who played a role in the insurrection. So we'll see how that goes. don't want to let it on too much, but
yeah, no, exactly.
Yeah,
but I think, you know, look,
it was a very odd thing to come across when I was going to the Poor People's Rally on Monday. The Poor People campaign had a kickoff for a couple of things. But yeah, I mean, like it's not just like groups like the Commonwealth Foundation in Pennsylvania that are influencing politics. We also have a whole bunch of like far right wing Christian white nationalists who are embedding themselves into Pennsylvania politics.
Well, let me say this is like, you know, with the Capitol opening back up is like one of the things, this is just one of the little examples, but I think that, you know, not to put you up on too big of a pedestal here, but I think there's few people that kind of work the Capitol in the way that you work the Capitol, right? The fact is, I give you a lot of shit for kind of just like hanging around and doing nothing and things like this. But the thing is, you know, like I know like firsthand is that kind of the discussions, the relationships that you've kind of built up inside the Capitol, right? You piece together that stuff in ways that most people don't, right? It's like, even like, say, you've got even good reporters, right? Who are looking for a story, kind of start looking at a story in through a particular lens. Like you're looking for what people are saying, what legislation is going to move forward. And I can remember early on in the days of Raging Chicken, when you were in the Capitol, when there were some of these kind of extreme proposals that were coming out from the Republican Party, that, you know, when you would talk to other journalists about that, they would say, look, it's never going to make it to the floor. It's never going to go anywhere. So we're not going to report on it. And you'd be like, nope, I'm going to write about that, because it showed you a direction and a tendency of where things were going. And so, you know, I mean, personally, I think that's going to be a value kind of with the Capitol being back open and having you back in it.
Yeah, no. I mean, like one of the things, like one of my like things, just like, especially where I'm at now, it's, you know, you go to an event, say today or tomorrow, yeah, it doesn't get reported on, but you have some video or photos of that. But, you know, like that type of stuff becomes relevant a month, 2, 3, 4 months, a year down the road. Like it's
exactly,
you know, there's doing that type of tracking and research into these organizations, like it's, or into these legislators, like something that you take on one day might not, it may seem odd or may seem irrelevant, but it becomes very relevant, you know, a month or two or a week or two or like a year down the line.
Well, I remember,
and you start piecing that stuff together.
Well, yeah, I mean, I remember this. I remember the reporting you were doing on, you know, just the video and filming stuff of the on the charter school stuff, right? You go into these hearings, and there's nobody there, right? Like everyone, they're literally phoning it in, right? And yet, there's these people coming forward pushing in a particular agenda, which is freaking devastating, right?
Yeah.
And I mean, be able to expose like just the insanity of the way that that kind of say that commission worked, right? I mean, even things like that are such a valuable kind of like look into our, you know, into actually what's happened in Harrisburg. So anyways, I didn't mean to turn this into like a promo for like SeanKitchen.org or something like that, but I'm just saying, I mean, I do think that is so important to be able to kind of do. And as people kind of begin to kind of reconvene in these ways, I expect that the speed for which this kind of stuff is happening is only going to increase.
And one of the things I'm really looking forward to, so we're going to talking about the Commonwealth Foundation, but it's also, I'm really looking forward to seeing people like, you know, Malcolm Kenyatta, Sarah Namorado, you know, all these people who I haven't been able to see over the past year, you know, like all the progressive legislators. Can't wait to finally like talk to Nikhil Saval, introduce myself to like the newer class that's in, you know, it's amazing being where we're at now, and people who I've been friends with for the past couple of years, or people I've known for the past several years, like Rick Krajewski,
right,
who's been doing amazing organizing work in Philadelphia, and now he's a state representative. You know, I've run across Rick a few times, and we've talked. It's kind of amazing being in this time and place where you start seeing your own friends, mm-hmm, and peers move into these spots as you are also on like a parallel path with them. Like, you know what I mean? Like, obviously not elected, but like within that same like world. And just like, it's really like something I would never would have thought of, like even 10 years ago when we started out with the chicken, or like, you know, getting involved with Occupy. But like seeing all my friends who like have made over the past couple of years with Occupy, protesting Tom Corbett, going after, you know, meeting at like Central High School on a cold December day, like the weeks before Tom Corbett leaves office, and making sure he never stepped foot into a Philadelphia public school for what he did to public education in Pennsylvania, and being there with, like, you know, like, I don't know if Rick was there, but like, you know, people like Rick and Helen Gim and like all these other people, and seeing them, like seeing Helen Gim get elected to office while like laying down on the red carpet next to her,
yeah,
like outside the Philadelphia Union League, is pretty cool. Like,
well, this is what, you know, like, what,
2012.
Yeah, what, you know, like, when I had, when I talked to, you know, on Out the Coop Live, kind of 2 weeks ago, when I talked to Representative Elizabeth Fiedler and Senator Nikhil Saval, right, when I kind of had them on the program, that's kind of where we started the conversation, because I came across, and I'm sorry if you all have listened to this already, but I came across this, you know, this article from like the summer before the election that, you know, Fiedler and Morato and Lee kind of all got elected. And it was this picture from the Philadelphia Inquirer of, you know, in reclaimed Philadelphia basement space. And there was like Lev Hirshhorn, right? Rick Krajewski, right? And I can't remember the other guy's name, but then Elizabeth Fiedler holding her kid in the front of it, right? And it was like that moment before all this broke loose, you know? And it was like to see them where
see
we are
reclaim
now.
Is that?
Yeah. And I, you know, I looked like that was 2018. And I'm like, at some level, that feels like a long time ago, but it was like just over 2 years ago. I mean, what has happened in that such a short period of time is really astonishing.
Yeah. I mean, like, going back to like Krasner getting elected, you know, like seeing Lancaster Stands Up turn into PA Stands Up, the statewide organization, like the first like, you know, like, it's just been very interesting, like, you know, like the Muslim ban that happened, you know, like with the 4 year anniversary of that was in January, like around the inauguration time.
Yeah.
And being just remembering, like, holy shit, like I was in that square in Lancaster 4 years ago you know, with the first main action that Lancaster stands up held. And the scene where, like, where Lancaster turns up, Lancaster stands up is turning like a into this powerhouse that's Pensum PA stands up right now. You know, like it's been fun watching this all unfold over the past 4 years and 5 years and all that. Like, especially from my vantage point here.
Oh, you're breaking up a little bit, Sean.
So. I mean, I guess we can get to, am I good now? Yeah, you were breaking up a little bit as well.
Okay, yeah, you said, from especially from your vantage point, I guess.
Yeah, it just seemed like the everything like going from here on out. Am I still like breaking up a bit?
No, am I breaking up?
No, you're good. I'm just looking at my screen. It's like yellow, like I got some yellow bars on there. But yeah, okay. I mean, like, and then also, I mean, this week, seeing like, you know, last week what happened, the Commonwealth Foundation and the minimum wage hearing that happened. Like, you have representatives Malcolm Kenyatta and John Galloway just shutting their bullshit down.
Right.
Forcing them to explain that they support a $0 minimum wage and there shouldn't be one at all. And like, you know, like the years of work that's gone in, like doing the research and the messaging, and you know, it's great seeing people using our research, like in their questioning of these organizations, stuff right. that you wouldn't have seen a couple years ago. You know, like Nikhil Saval going after John or Gene Barr from the Chamber of Industry, who's sort of seen like this like great guy on both sides of the aisle, and Nikhil's like, no, you're making $500,000 a year and you're telling me why there shouldn't be a minimum wage? Like, fuck you. Like, you know what I mean?
Right.
Like, you know, it's great seeing that attitude changing too. So
no, it's fantastic. It's fantastic. Let's see what else we got here. Oh yeah, let's talk about the Commonwealth Foundation. Just because, like, that was that
just did.
I'm sorry. I mean, yeah. Sorry, I know. I just, but
the, yeah. Oh no, we were about to say like that here. Those videos.
Yes, clips. Exactly.
Yeah, the video clips of Malcolm Kenyatta and Galloway just going on the offense in this hearing was absolutely amazing. You know, one of the reasons why I love Kenyatta, and you know, like. I don't think if people have figured it out on my Twitter account, but, you know, I am supporting Kenyatta in this Senate primary, specifically for how he is like in committee and on the floor and really just doesn't take people's bullshit and just goes on the offensive with this stuff. I mean, I would admit Kenyatta is someone who I probably wasn't like too fond of, you know, during the primary and him getting out in Biden and shitposting against Sanders. But like, you know, I feel like he is going to be the left progressive, the most progressive candidate in the Senate race. I think he has taken that mantle up pretty strongly over the past several months. And, you know, like he's showing people he's more than just a brand.
Yep.
You know, like he's doing the work. He's raising our issues within the progressive community. You know, he's going on MSNBC and like other outlets and just, you know, talking about the issues that we are fighting as a movement right now in Pennsylvania.
Absolutely. Like, really?
Yeah.
Well, I mean, I think like he has been one of the best voices that we've seen in some of these hearings. I mean, you know, the number of sound clips that we played, you know, this is before he announced he was going to run, but sound clips we played.
You play a podcast worth of like clips.
Totally. I mean, and in part, like, you know, he's just asking the right questions and pushing back. I mean, to see these videos of them holding like, you know, these folks from the Commonwealth Foundation, like, you know, to task, like to basically take it into the task, right? And holding them accountable to the positions and make sure everybody knows what their positions are.
And then you have Brad Wood going, excuse me, Mr. Kenyatta, can you please? And just Malcolm just like slapping him out of the way metaphorically, like.
Right. Well, like,
you're just not going to stop him from like doing what he does best.
Right. But the thing is, too, is that the fact that the Republicans now have to step in to try to shut down discussion. I mean, you know, because they don't want this stuff to come out. Usually they're able to go, let, you know, whatever you say this, they get some innocuous questions, whatever. But Kenyatta, like, you know, not only is he asking the questions and pushing it, but right, he's asking in such a way, but that shit goes viral, right? I mean, that gets out there and it breaks through the normal reporting that would normally happen in those sessions, that's what's so, I think, critical about what he's doing.
Yeah. And we're also seeing a change in philosophy with the House and Senate Democrats and the caucus and their communication strategy and how they are getting these clips out there and, you know, really utilizing these clips in a viral way, especially on like Twitter and Facebook. I mean, like, it's, yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. So that's fantastic. Check out the stuff from Toomey. I really don't care about Toomey right now, but he just pissed me off with that whole idea that, you know, he's going to step in the way of legislation.
Fuck the poors.
Yeah, I mean, he's just like, you know, come on. He's like, that was one of the gaps. Now, I've heard different versions of this, but, you know, the whole idea that, you know, in the original legislation that was passed under Trump, like for that rescue package, the CARES Act or whatever, when that got passed, it included provision. Wait, no, I was this. No, it was not in that one, but in the second one, something like this. But there was one of the versions of this that included provision that would prevent debtors from coming after that. In this, what's it called now? The American Rescue Act. Is that what it is? I don't know.
American Rescue Plan.
Rescue Plan. So in this one, it did not contain a provision which would prevent debtors from kind of taking that stimulus check that was coming out. There's some questions about why that is. There's some questions about whether or not, or at least I saw people raise this as like, well, you could not have included that provision as part of reconciliation in that. I don't know if that's true, but for whatever reason, that was not included in this plan. So Toomey basically used that as a shield and say, well, if you didn't want debtors to come get it, you should have included the legislation. Not my fault. Too late now. I'm done with it. So he's blocking legislation to prevent that from happening, which is messed up. All the more reason that say, sayonara, see you later. Let's get somebody in there that actually can do the job right. And for that, so the last thing I want to talk about today is for this section here is just a hearing that took place yesterday. This was the state Senate budget hearings you had Chancellor Dan Greenstein, Pashi Chancellor Dan Greenstein, basically testifying. Basically, that he was clearly agitated. If you watched any of the budget hearings yesterday, it was like or his testimony before it. He's like, you know, moving all around the place. He couldn't kind of keep still. It was just kind of a strange performance to kind of see on Zoom to begin with. Right. His like teeth seemed particularly like clenched throughout the whole thing. It was just kind of an odd thing. But anyways, there was the one point, you know, he's been pushing. You know, we had the folks from Lockhaven on this past Monday on Out the Coop Live talking about their kind of pushback against these merger plans between Lockhaven, Bloomsburg, and Mansfield. There's similar kind of pushbacks that are happening out in kind of Western PA. But so this is kind of like the time where, you know, we're going to hear what the plan is. And look, basically, Greenstein is basically saying, you know, issued a threat during that hearing. Now, he claimed afterwards, well, that wasn't a threat. It was just a statement of fact. But this is kind of exactly what it's designed to do. So I just want to play this clip for you all so you can hear it firsthand. So you're not just hearing my characterizations of this. And then I just want to talk a little about some kind of what I see some of the issues with it. So here you go. This is I'm spacing the guy's name who's doing the questioning at this point. But
Joe Pittman?
Yeah, Joe Pittman. And then here's the Pittman's question and then Chance's response.
That's where I'm struggling at this point, Chancellor, because I'm wondering what the value add of being part of the state system even is at this point.
So, Senator, unless we figure this out, I will be recommending to the board that we come back to the Senate next year with a legislative package to dissolve the system, because if we continue to go down this path, what you're going to see is that cross-subsidization is going to drain all of us. Well, and then what does that mean?
So there you go. So basically, this is him coming out and basically saying that, no, we can no longer support smaller schools in the system, places like Mansfield and things like this. We can no longer do that. And if you guys don't accept my package, then basically what's going to happen, I'm going to come back with a package of legislation that is going to dissolve the state system. And then Pittman follows that up with basically saying, yeah, I'll introduce that legislation for you.
I guarantee you, I wouldn't be surprised if that was a question forwarded to Pittman by someone in the chancellor, side, Pasci or the chancellor's office.
That's what it sounded like to me. That sounded to me like that was a setup.
That's how these questions happen all the time on both sides of the situation. Any budget hearing, you have journalists, you have usually have you know, journalists, anyone from these organizations or stakeholder organizations within these within, like, you know, that are associated with the groups testifying, the state agencies are testifying.
Right.
And this completely sounded like a setup question that was forwarded to Pittman by someone within Greenstein's office or within the state system.
Right.
Just hearing that for the first time. I mean, like,
yep.
Yeah.
Like you can hear it. It was teed up, right? I mean, this was laid there for him to deliver that line. Right. So what happens, right? Just to get a little kind of macro here, kind of what Sean is pointing up, is that the reason why you do that, right, is like, and then back away from it, right? Because a little bit later on, he kind of backs away. Well, I wasn't kind of saying it was a threat, right? Because State Senator Vincent Hughes comes on and said, well, you issued a threat. And Green says, no, it wasn't a threat. I was just talking about the seriousness and the gravity of this. But the reason why you do that is that you put that into the bloodstream. Right. You deliver that. Right. Even if you're going to back away from it. And basically what you've told all the faculty, staff and students at all of these universities. Right. Is to be afraid. Right. Is to be afraid and be scared. And
I also think it was kind of like to check the temperature of other people within government, too, because.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, like, Governor Wolf came out right away and said he will not support any legislation dissolving the state system of higher education. So we'll see about that. But I mean, like, I think he was trying to do a temperature check on where people were at with that.
But this is my point, though, right? But my point is this, right? The goal, yes, Wolf came out and said that, right? But I know this for a fact, just hearing some faculty talk about some of this in the aftermath, is like, basically, that put everybody on notice. It's the same kind of crap when they tell us locally at each university they're going to go through retrenchment, right? Sometimes they mean it. Sometimes it's just out there as a threat. But what that does is that makes everybody put their head down and worry. So instead of organizing, they think organizing is actually going to be something that will contribute to the downfall of the thing that they're fighting for. So and what I heard that as very, very much, because there were several different town hall meetings and organizing events that had took place across the state this past week, right? One of them being at kind of Lock Haven. There was this press conference about this, about the mergers. Tomorrow at 10 a.m. Up in Lock Haven, there's going to be a protest organized by AFSCME and ABSCUF and some student organizations up there. Basically, it's a message to them. If you continue to push back upon these plans, you are going to be responsible for the dissolution of the state system. And I know these folks enough that it's going to cause some of them people to worry and bolt and not want to organize because they don't want to be the cause of the downfall of the system, right? It is an anti-union, anti-organizing tactic to introduce fear into this discussion, right? And I can't, and I've mentioned this 1,001 times.
It's probably also a veiled threat at the organizing students doing a Kutztown.
Totally.
Those students that
took him to task, right? And the president of Hawkinson for the kind of racist cop that they've got, they've got hired, they're keeping him on staff there for the lack of access to mental health services on campus, right? Things that they've been organizing around or continuing to organize around, all that stuff. He's feeling the heat. So what he's introducing is he's introducing the threat there. And it's also a message to all the university presidents to tamp all that shit down on all the campuses. Right. That's what goes on. So that's number one. Right. So this is like the masks off moment for all those faculty members that have been out there, for all those staff members that have been out there, who have been out trying to kind of work with the chancellor and try to kind of do the shared governance thing that the chancellor claims that he wants to do. And we're going to play with the administration. This is a masks off moment for you people. Right. I'm just saying, it's like, there you go. The guy's telling you that he's issuing you a threat that either you do what I want, right? Or I'm gonna wreck everything, right? I'm gonna just freaking mess all this shit up. I'll destroy what you love. That's what he's telling them, right? And I'll tell you, it's like this is a classic example of what goes on, and this is why. This is why there's two things. There's two things that have happened like over the past several years, which brought us to this moment, right? Number one, and I said this on Twitter last night, as well as on Facebook, right? The dissolution and the destruction of the PA Student Power Network, right, has put student movements in this state, especially in the states of higher education, back like a decade. That organization, right, was the first time, and I, look, I've been working with student organizers as long as I've been at Kutztown, since 2002. And that was the first time that you saw an organic grassroots organizing rank and file model of student organizing across the state. Was it the perfect organization? Did the organization kind of like, you know, have its fits and starts? Of course it did. Something that monumental, right? Moving across the state, trying to organize 14 campuses in every corner of this, right? And I remember, you know, we've talked about him on the show before, so I don't feel bad calling him out here. James Sersonsky was one of the organizers for them who got that off the ground, that I helped work with him on the early days of getting that organization off the ground. And he would literally travel all over the state and work with these organizers. And some of these organizers, some of the chapters that were being forming across the state were just absolutely incredible. And they were in their infancy. And instead of progressive organizations across the state making sure that that organization thrived, right, we let it die. And that's on us, because it didn't need to die. And I'm not going to get into the details or the rumors or the background about why that happened, but I can tell you that did not have to happen. So that's number one. We destroyed, and I didn't personally, but they did not get the support they had, and there's segments of the left that are responsible for that organization going away, and that they're not being a statewide organized student movement right now. Number one. Number two, you've heard me talk about this before, is that after our strike, ABSCUF strike in 2016, right, we had an opportunity. We had in my view, a once-in-a-generation opportunity to capitalize on the organized power that we had built up on that strike and to move that into like deep organizing across the state at that point. We had an organizer at the state office who was 100% behind that. This guy, Chris, who was an amazing organizer, who helped us kind of do this, was kind of giving us workshops on our campus about how to do the deep organizing that we needed on our campus. And by deep organizing, I don't mean just going signing up people for union membership. I mean organizing people with strategies of how you fight back locally, how you act collectively, how to think about organizing, how to have conversations with your coworkers to ensure that you could have addressed problems at a local level. You've heard me talk about Mike Gambone, my friend at Kutztown, who he attempted to do this locally at Kutztown. Like, and again, I'm using that as a shorthand. Like, Mike wasn't the only one that was involved in that, but I know Mike was out in front, right? And again, that was not the model that was supported, right? Instead, we retreated as a union. And I can speak for myself. I feel personally in part guilty in part of that. But I can tell you also, I was absolutely 100% spent at that point. I was exhausted. If we had not gone to a strike in 2016, I was going to go on the job market in 2016 because I was so disgusted with everything that was going on at Kutztown. I had my application letter ready. I had all this kind of stuff going. I was starting to approach people about letters of recommendation to get the hell out because I was destroyed by what they had done to education at Kutztown University and the lies that were coming from the administration. And it felt personally, it was too much of a mental tax. It was too much of a mental tax on me to maintain that. But when it looked like we were going to do the real organizing, real power, and actually move towards a real strike this time, I was like, there's no way I'm leaving for this. I'm going to be here for that. And I was our strike captain. I was work with Mike Gambone on kind of organizing. I had an amazing team of organizers to make what was going on at Kutztown. That was happening across the state. And if we had different union leadership, a different mentality at the time, I could see an approach being, say, we are not going to let this go away. We are going to help support this kind of organizing and double down on it. We are going to issue messages to all our chapter presidents that you need to keep this going. And we are going to give the resources to help you do it. Instead, and I don't know the reasons why, but I can just tell you in the aftermath of that, there was a slow return to business as usual. Having small groups of leaders, of leaderships at each campus kind of work. And this wasn't true on every campus, but in many, if not most. small groups of people that would be working directly with the administration, and everybody else went back to kind of like, you know, live their lives. It's like what happened like after the Obama victory, right? Win this big victory that everybody goes back home and goes back to brunch or whatever, right? And at now, when you see this full-on assault of going on against the state system of higher education, right? And a chancellor who's got, look, frankly, he's got more skills than any other chancellors that have been up until now, right? Because this guy comes out of, you know, big money, Microsoft, you know, Bill and Gates, you know, Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, higher education stuff. And he learned all his talk and strategy from the Silicon Valley folks, right? You know, we're outgamed. And we don't have the organized infrastructure in order to accomplish that. And that is not on the fault of like any one individual or any fault of people, because I know there's people who have been trying their best to organize as best they can. But we just objectively speaking, we do not have that organized power at that point. Now, again, it's happening. People organizing and things like this. There are students that are organizing. There are faculty that are organizing. AFSCME is organizing. That's all going to happen, right? So there's the good. But this, we cannot forget this lesson, right? It's like, every single time that we allow a new chancellor to come in and we're like going to play nicely with these people, we get smacked. Every time that we believe the garbage that comes out of their mouth about, yeah, working together, we get smacked. And this time around, there's a highly competent guy there that's going to do this, and people are going to get hurt. Students are going to lose their programs. Local towns are going to, our economies are going to be crushed, and faculty are going to lose their jobs, right? And he's going to all do that and basically saying, and if you don't do that, I'm going to dissolve everything. That's what we're talking about. So everybody, masks off. Masks off. On deck now, if you're a part of the state system of higher education, you kind of care about public higher education in this state, now's the time. All right, this is Kevin Mahoney, editor and founder of Raging Chicken Press. We're going to be back right after this quick message with this week's Last Call. This is Kevin Mahoney, editor and founder of Raging Chicken Press. For the past 7 years, Raging Chicken Press has brought pull-no-punches, progressive reporting and commentary to the interwebs. Our long-form investigative pieces, stories that no access journalist wants to touch, or rollicking weekly podcasts strive to advance progressive movements and perspectives rooted in the struggles happening across the country or down the street. We've broken national stories and caused our share of discomfort in the halls of power. If we want a progressive future, we need progressive media. And you can help support Pull No Punches, homegrown progressive media today. Become a member of Raging Chicken Press for as little as $5 a month. Simply go to patreon.com/rcpress and choose your membership level. We need to make sure to keep the movement in the media and the media in the movement. Best way you can do that is to become a member of Raging Chicken today by going to patreon.com/rcpress. Thank you for your energy, your encouragement, and your support. Keep up the fight. Welcome back, everybody. This is Kevin Mahoney, editor and founder of Raging Chicken, here with Sean Kitchen for this week's Last Call. We talked space news, we talked beer news, all sorts of fun stuff. But breaking news right at the top of things, Sean, to you.
I think we should all thank Donald Trump for Joe Biden hitting his 100 million shots in 100 days, the first 100 days. Actually, on day 58, you know, the fucking discourse around this week, man. like the questions that people were asking, like, how come you're not thanking or praising Donald Trump for this? And I love Psaki's response, 500,000 people died.
Yeah.
There's no praise for this.
That's why. That's why.
Yeah.
Yeah, she's like, I mean, lover, you know, lover or hater, I mean, she is a highly competent, like, warrior when it comes to this. Yeah, I mean, no, she's more than a spokesperson. She's a warrior for that. You know, and again, this is going to be a problem when it comes to some issues, but man, I'm loving snark.
I was watching, whatchamacallit, Pod Save America this week. You know, I've been watching it more this just to see what they're saying.
Well, you know, as you move closer into the center and into the insider circle, of course you guys start watching them more.
Yeah. But no, I mean, like they said, it's like, it's the return of like tan suit journalism. Like, it's like, but I mean, like, it's like, why the fuck do we have to give Trump credit for the vaccine? Like, I really hope people just say like, the 100 million, like, just whenever the people start asking these questions, I would love Psaki just to like have a list of headlines of all the vaccination failures from Trump. That'd and just great. Start reading them off with the date.
Yep.
Boom. New York Times this day. Boom. Oh, NBC well, News. Oh, you said this on this day here.
Right. And let's be clear, right? The there's the vaccine and then there's the vaccinations, right? So let's say that, look, I mean, cause the move to, you know, from beginning to end of the process of achieving this vaccine, that is something that's huge, right? I mean, there's no way around it, right? But it was done, let's be clear, done by private industry, right?
It was done by German scientists.
Right. But let's also be clear that there, you know, the fact that the federal government kind of supported those efforts, the fact that they went through and they did things in rapid sec, that's absolutely critical. How like, much you want?
Operation Warp Speed had nothing really to do with it.
Well, it did have some. I mean, it did. Right. I mean, I'm not gonna like throw the baby out with the bathwater. I recognize that there was definitely an impact on that, but I also know that it was not Trump's idea. Right. I also know there's people, whatever in his like field of vision, that were telling him this is what you got to do, and that's what they did. So okay. Even if I'm going to give a piece of the credit, right, on the kind of move to the vaccination, let's be clear. At the beginning of this year, when Biden took office, right, the reports came back when they were trying to get an update on stuff. They found out there was zero plans for the vaccine rollout. They had nothing. So basically what Trump did is basically say, okay, private industry, we'll agree to buy a bunch of stuff. You go ahead and do this. Right, he's a lazy piece of shit. We should say it right from the. That's you got to understand that. So he sits.
He spent more time talking about the election than he did talking about the vaccines.
So talks about that, hands it over. So these companies bust their butts, right, in order to kind of accomplish that and achieve this thing, which is huge, right? So he does that, but he makes no provisions to actually get it in people's arms. So literally, if you want to say why are we giving Biden so much credit, there you go, right there. That team that went in there basically in warp speed set up a vaccination plan and turned this into what could have been an additional like year of the virus because there was no plan to roll it out and ramping up production so much.
Yeah, the fact that a third of the country or just under a third of the country is now like their first shot.
I'll be part of that on Tuesday, man.
8 days.
Yep.
Yeah, my mom's union. You know, is got everything set up for my mom to get her vaccinations. She doesn't even have to go to the hospital or a pharmacy to do it. She's going to her union hall in Philadelphia to go get her shots.
Freaking awesome.
Like, yeah. I mean, like you talk about like people shit on unions and stuff like that. You want to know what unions did? Like unions, like my mom's she's in her union. She has some complaints about it at times, but you know what? My mom's union did a lot for her over this past year when she's been furloughed. You know, she was able to retain her job because of the union, didn't lose her job. She was brought back to work because of the union. Like she had job security through this whole entire time. And now her union is getting her vaccinated to where she's going to the union hall in Philadelphia to go get her vaccine shot done.
It's awesome.
And my mom is not in the 1A crowd either. I mean, she technically could be for a couple of issues, but you know, other than that, like she's 63 years old. She is, you know, she doesn't have to wait in line. She doesn't have to fuck around with the rollout plan here. Now, granted, like the world's been slower in Pennsylvania, but you know, we don't have the infrastructure in place. And you know what? You know, I might sound like greedy about this, but good. I'm glad my mom's getting the shot and she doesn't fuck around through the market and getting this like shit on her own.
Yep.
You know, my dad was able to get a shot that day Rite Aid announced, but like that was botched a bit. Like, so now both my parents will be vaccinated. And I am glad about that. So
yeah, and I could say that I'm going to be I'm getting
and they'll be vaccinated by the time we go on vacation.
That's awesome. And I'm going to be vaccinated through Bucks County. And so after registering at virtually every freaking hospital or whatever like this around in the area, because that's because it's so disjointed, Bucks County finally got its kind of its stuff together. And I actually got an email late on Wednesday night, I guess, and said, "Hey, you're ready to go." I'm like, whoa, boom, got right in. So, and right down, right here in Percocet, I don't need to kind of drive. Like my wife was looking for, like, well, you can go to Lockhaven,
like right? Levittown, or
right, exactly. No, like literally, like 3-4 hours away for something. I'm like, I know, for you know, if it's one shot, that's one thing, but for the two shot thing, something that's like 3 hours away, it's a little much. But so that's great. So let me run through this real quick and then we'll get out of here today. I'm just starting to, I had a couple bad incidents of, I get these ocular migraines, which I get these flashing lights and stuff. So I had a couple of that today and I'm starting to get some of it to come back now. So I don't want to hang out too long on the screen because it's been effective. But anyways, cool stuff. Check out the links in today about this week's space news. The big deal, I think, is we'll find what happens with the space launch system, the SLS rocket that's been kind of like years behind, but it is the most powerful rocket that's ever been built. SpaceX is also supposed to be testing its next round of the of Starship. That'd be, I think, SN11 at this point, which they're kind of also in a race to have something that's a reusable rocket that will be able to go to the moon. Looks like they're going to be pushing forward with the Artemis mission to the moon. At the same time, we talked about this last week. The Biden administration is conducting a review of the SLS system for looking for efficiencies and costs and stuff. They're really careful about saying this. We're not trying to scrub the program, but I think this is pressure to get them to, you know, get past the finish line. The other big news was that you had a large amount of water seems to be locked within the planet's outer crust on Mars. This is kind of a big deal, right, for any kind of future plans to spend any time, whether you're talking about, you know, whatever the fantasy plans of Techno King Musk, or if you're talking about just simply scientific missions for any kind of extended period of time to Mars. If this pans out, and again, some of the answers that we're going to get through Curiosity rover, some of the answers we're going to get through the Perseverance rover, that if there is water kind of embedded in the crust, that might mean that we will be able to extract kind of water from the minerals in the outer crust, which would be a significant achievement to be able to have a kind of a local source of water on Mars spread out across the entire planet, not just located in the ice cap. So really fascinating report that came out in the journal Science this week about that, saying that, you know, they know that there was used to be a lot of water on Mars. However, now they're looking at maybe 30 to 99% of the water that used to be there might be embedded in the crust. So pretty cool. Yeah, got the Elon Musk. Yeah, like I said, Techno King. He put himself down as Techno King, and Zach Kirkhorn is his chief financial officer, will be the master of coin. You know, some of the reporting on this has just been hilarious this week, just because it's been like, you know, we don't really understand what the move was and what it's actually going to be referred to. Maybe it's because of the Musk's recent interest in Bitcoin. I'm like, no, he's just being a boy. He's just like, hey, let's name ourselves something stupid. And because I have so much crazy amount of money, I could do it. And it'd be so fun. Right. I mean, that's really the kind of culture here. But the Master of Coin, I thought, was particularly apt, right? Coming directly out of, especially in the aftermath of Game of Thrones and all that, which is fun. A couple announcements about free will. You've got one of the new releases is Personified. It's a double IPA. Brewed with a base of flaked oats and wheat, hopped with the kettle in an old favorite Simcoe, and then double dry hopped with Citra, Azaka, and extra Simcoe for good measure. Mashed high, hopped appropriately, and seemingly an emerging house yeast coming about. We're thrilled. They're thrilled with that one, and I hope they will too. Tons of juicy clementines up front, followed by more grapefruit and citrus-esque undertones, which washes away with notes of peach cream savor. And it comes in at 8.4 ABV. And this is the big week. This Sunday at Free Will, they have their launch of their barrel age flour series. These are great sours. They have a kind of different mix every year, but thus far they've been looking at some chamomile. I think red clover was one of them, which I don't remember them doing before. They usually have a dandelion, so that all that stuff is coming out this week, so you can actually check all that out at their this Sunday at both locations. Let me just kind of look at something. At both locations, that'll be available. You can also kind of check them out online at freewillbrewing.com, freewillbrewing.store, I should say. And they got some great releases. I do have to say that I was able to pick up the Sputnik 36, which is an Irish dry stout, which is really good. And I'm just spacing the name of it. I wish I could remember it, but it was their first time that they did a really heavy barrel age, bourbon barrel age stout, or dark with that rivaled that of Ralphius. Right. I did pick up a 4-pack of those cans. I have not touched it yet, though, because I've got just too much work to do and I can't afford to lose a day. So anyways, so do check that out. Go to freewillbrewing.store. You can order online. Their new releases are not posted yet. They will be posted tomorrow. And then Sunday, their sour flour, bottled flour, aged bottle, whatever. You can tell I'm fading at this point. Okay. Sean, what else you got going on this weekend, man?
Nothing too much.
Weather's supposed to be nice. Does that mean the camera comes out?
Not yet. So yeah, the weather's gonna be nice. I'm probably gonna go out running. I'm gonna be getting a tripod soon, which I'm gonna be fucking looking forward to. I'm gonna get a 10-stop neutral density filter with that. So if people don't know what that is, basically like a neutral density filter allows you to really slow down your shutter speed to like when it's bright out to like, you know, to where you want it. So it's really great for video, especially something I need for video. But I really wanted to try doing some long exposure shots this spring and summer once the weather gets nice. Like we have like a dam that's right down the street from me.
Oh, nice. Yeah, it's always great.
So like stuff like that, the river was going to be really high in springtime. So I'm really looking forward to, you know, messing around on the riverfront. Again, some like really long exposure shots in the morning when it's like golden hour. Mm-hmm. And it's also where I'm not like boosting my aperture up to where it's like, I'm getting a lot of diffraction and, you know, destroying the image. Shout out to my friend, Danny.
Yeah, Floyd. No kidding, man. I saw that come up in one of my feeds that she bought. Yes. One of your picks.
Yes, my friend Danny from the Senate, she bought the bridge shot that I have from the snowstorm. So looking forward, you know, thanking her for that. She doesn't listen to the podcast, but shout out anyway. My sister got hired at the my sister's gonna be graduating nursing school in a couple months, in May, and she got hired full time at the hospital she's been working at for the past year as a student nurse.
Super, you know, hell of a time, man. Congratulations to her. That's awesome.
Hell of a time to be involved going to nursing school and doing your student nursing program, you know, and getting paid for it. I don't know if it's a union hospital, but I feel like she's going to get a really good starting salary out of that, which is great. So, you know, there's a lot of good things going on right now. Not a whole much else going on. I'm going to be enjoying the weather this weekend. Finally, it's going to be warm again. It's been fucking cold this week.
Yeah, I know. It put me in a bad mood. I'm telling you, I got up like early Monday morning and I had to go out and walk my dog. And it was so bitter cold. And I was just in a miserable mood for like the first 3 days of the week because I was just like, but this weekend we're supposed to get it, you know, up and, you know, up into the 60s maybe, which would be good. But you know, I do have to say, I'm really happy to hear that, you know, you're going to have a, you're finally going to get, you know, having a shutter speed that is going to match the pace of your work week. So that's great.
yeah,
it's going to be good. And I also have to, you know, give you kudos on your new profile pic. Although it's, you know, I got to say, it reminds me of something that Zach Roberts posted a while back, and I don't know if he's going to be too happy with that.
That's actually from last year at the summit.
Yeah, I remember.
Which, yeah, I decided to like change up a bit, but it's it's you know, going out with one of my neighbors this week, we'll see how that goes. You know, we've been one of my neighbors, someone, like, when they put Proud Boy stickers up and down my neighborhood, I was asking her if, like, she could pull footage from their security camera, and we started talking. So definitely interested. You know, she wants to hear the stories I have about the past year in Harrisburg, what it's been like with my job. So, you know, it's been, but I will say one thing, you know, it's been very therapeutic to actually talk to people about what I experienced in Harrisburg this past year and not keeping these emotions, like, bottled up, you know, because, like, it was one hell of a year, going back to the pandemic and the reopen rallies and then, like, all the election stuff, the pre-election stuff. And then, you know, going to all the Stop the Steal rallies and following these people around. And, no, I mean, like, it still is, like, holy shit. Like, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
I witnessed something in history. like it's, you know, I've always wanted to do that journalism part, be a journalist, like, ever since college, but, like, I'm doing the research work, you know, obviously with PA Spotlight, but it's the type of stuff where it still feels like it's like journalism. Like, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like, being able to go to this past year and document this and take photos and videos of all these rallies that sparked the insurrection in January.
Yeah.
Like, you know, I mean, like, the work that, you know, for, if Jordan's listening, you know, who's was on the podcast, you so keep up with it, because it's, you don't know, like, the avenues, like, this type of work will lead to.
Yeah, exactly. 100%.
I mean, like, it's, yeah, I still, like, can't get over the fact that, you know, we watched this, you know, we watched this, I watched this insurrection unfold in real time, going back to March of last year when the reopen rallies first started. And, you know, it kind of, it, you know, like, talking to some, you know, reporters about it, and, you know, like, they were fucking just blown away by it. Like, we're blown away to the point where I could just, blown away to the point where I could just talk about it with a straight face and be so, like, with candor, like, you know what I mean? Be straight to the point without, like, and they're just like, wow. And I'm just like, what? You're like, this ain't normal. I was like, it feels normal for me.
Yeah. No, absolutely. Well, you know, one of the things that, that's as amazing as that is, I think that, you know, there's some current concern now just being reported, and this might put a cap on your, you know, your kind of professional, aspirations, Sean. So I'm just a bit concerned. I want to put it out there that, 5 White House staffers have just been fired because of their use of marijuana. So
are you serious?
Yeah. They just talked about it, and it's unclear about it. I mean, just kind of, it's a story at this point. I think it's going to get out there, but it's, it says 5 White House staffers have been fired because their past use of drugs, including marijuana, Press Secretary Jen Psaki said on Friday. Marijuana has become a delicate issue for the Biden administration because 15 states in Washington, D.C. allow for its recreational usage despite federal prohibition. The administration has tried to not automatically penalize potential staffers for legal behavior in their communities by developing more flexible policy, Psaki said, but they had to lose their jobs. Now, what's the background story? You said there were some other instances and things like this, but just thought I'd
put that out there. I think it's bullshit, you know.
That's why I'm telling you.
Oh no. Well, like, well, there's a couple of things. My marijuana usage in the past and my tweets are gonna stop me. I will not be getting any transition job in the future or any job within you know, but it's also like with stuff like this, you know, there are a number of legislators, number of senators, number of Republicans in office, another Democrats in office who smoke.
Yeah.
Like this is just bullshit. Like, you know what I mean? And
yeah,
I could see if they were dealing drugs, that could be an issue.
Yeah. I mean, who knows what the issue is. I find the story like that kind of breaks in the news and things like this to be just really, it just shows you kind of like, you know, whatever. It's a certain kind of reporting that I find extraordinarily frustrating because it's like, doesn't get to, I mean, it tries to make this big, like, you know, oh, hypocrisy or challenge or conflict.
It's also
or
something
scandal.
Like the boomers will use, it's something that the boomers will use against you. And the boomers tried using against me with a previous job,
for
admitting my marijuana use. The boomers in the labor movement didn't like the fact that I said I smoke pot.
Yeah, yeah.
And they wanted me gone.
Yep.
So, you know, like, get with the time.
Yes, I remember that. You said you smoked pot right in the pages of Raging Chicken, too, as well. Right, exactly.
I think that blog article might be gone. I'm not sure.
Yeah, it might be. It might be. Anyways. Look, all right, like, man. I'm gonna hit the road before my eyes completely give out of me. So
hit the pipe.
Not the pipe, no. But yeah. So listen, man. Have a great weekend. It's supposed to be great weather. I hope you enjoy some of it. And good luck with the opening of the Capitol next week. I look forward to kind of hearing and seeing kind of the stuff that you do. And,
I'm really looking forward to taking my camera in there. I'm really looking forward to using my new lens in there for the first time.
Yeah, indeed.
There are a couple like statues in there. They're like awesome to shoot. There's a statue of the Abraham Lincoln in there, like in the Ryan office building. Yeah, I'm looking forward to like that type of stuff.
Oh, cool, man.
So,
well, have a good one. Enjoy the opening of the Capitol. And everybody on Out to Coop Live this week, we are going to have it's going to be an open session on what's happening with Poshy. And an update on our membership stuff and upcoming shows.